Greece, the Fed, and television festivals. Fun, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's great to have you with us here on this Friday, the 19th of June. And we're going to start the show off the way we do every Friday with our weekly wrap, where we ask smart folks to come in and give us their take on the most important stories of the week gone by. We've got Lynette Lopez with us from Business Insider and Sudeep Reddy with The Wall Street Journal. Hey, guys.
Hey. Hey.
So let's start with Greece. I know it's a lot to talk about in a short amount of time, but we have Greeks pulling billions of euros out of banks this week. The ECB had to step in with emergency funding. Default looming at the end of the month. Lynette, how bad is this?
Well, the first rule of capital flight is don't talk about capital flight, because that just means everybody's going to start freaking out and pulling their money out. This is bad. I mean, if you looked at Greece's budget and all the deals that they've been doing, the write-downs that they're taking for their state budget, they have way less money than they thought they did. It's a wonder whether or not they're going to be able to pay government workers. They have this IMF debt looming, emergency meetings on Monday. It's a hot mess. It's not looking great. And now they're even thinking about taking money from Putin, where I don't know where that guy's going to get money, but I wouldn't want to take money from him.
So Sudeep, like Lynette said, there's this emergency meeting on Monday in Brussels. Where do you think this is headed?
Well, we've always known that conditions were going to get worse in Greece. That's just been the path that we've been on for the last 5 years. They obviously have not had the kind of pickup in their economy. They haven't had all the core things you would need to see a different scenario than we're having now. We've also learned all along that talks involving Greece never get done until the 11th hour. So that is what we're headed toward on Monday. If there is a deal to be had, it's always going to be at that last minute, at that final summit, and this could be it. The Greek people have been building toward this for a very long time, hoping that things would improve. Obviously, they haven't, so they have to make a really big decision, and Europe has to make a really big decision, too, about whether they need to figure out a way to all come together or just part ways and figure out a whole different path, since the path they've been on for 5 years hasn't worked.
Lynette, do you think we're going to have an all come together or a part ways situation here?
I think that we're going to have a bare minimum of what needs to be done. And we're going to muddle along more. And the danger there is that the longer we muddle along, the longer the Greek people suffer, the more potential there is for the rise of radical political parties. And that's what we don't want in Europe. We don't want anybody extreme from the right or the left preying on the fragility and helplessness or hopelessness of any society there.
Great. Let's move on to the Fed here. Sudeep, what do you make of Fed Chair Janet Yellen's statement this week? Were there any surprises in there for you?
The surprises were the fact that the Fed, at this point, we're now 6 years into an economic recovery, was still not willing to say, to give the all clear and say it's okay to move on. The Fed was really just signaling how they're nervously tiptoeing toward the exit. Yellen's core message was really fairly simple. Yes, we're on track to raise rates, but when we do, please don't panic. It's going to be okay. It's not about just the first rate hike. It's about the path of what rates are going to look like for years down the road. That is a very difficult message to sell to markets. And we know there's going to be some turbulence when we get to that point. It's just a question of how much turbulence and whether it can be contained to a short period or whether it extends out for a longer period.
And Lynette, do you think we'll get that all clear this year? Are we going to see rates rise in September or December, maybe?
I don't think we're going to see rates rise. I think, wake me up when Janet raises them. Other than that, I'm going to just kick it here. You know, we're watching wage growth. We're watching the steadiness of the economy. She's going to raise rates when things are looking steady and secure. I don't see it yet. I don't know why people are forcing it. The bond sell-off has started already in anticipation that this is going to happen, so rates are rising naturally right now. Who knows if it's just going to be choppy and people will start buying it. I don't know. Wake me up when Janet raises them. That's it.
All right. Before we go, I want to get your really quick thoughts on the Pope calling out rampant consumerism this week. Does it matter? Sudeep?
It does matter. The Pope has obviously carries all this moral force. And when we all talk about raw economics and raw markets and basic science, that's not enough. You have to get into the moral issues and the big force of that. And that's what he's doing.
And Lynette?
I must have missed that while I was shopping on Amazon on my Apple Watch. Just joking. I think it's a great message. And I think this Pope has been magnificent in creating a friendlier, more malleable, modern Catholic Church. And, you know, he's a leader that is not afraid to change who he is and what he is based on the times and humanity and changing ideas. I think it's great.
Lynette Lopez is with Business Insider. Sudeep Reddy with The Wall Street Journal. Thank you both.
Thanks, Adrian.
On Wall Street today, nothing but the wah-wah trombones. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's a good time to be a television fan. There is more TV out there than anyone could watch, but the sheer volume can make it hard for new shows to stand out. Enter the Television Fest. It's like a film fest, but for fancy-sounding episodic content. As we speak, the first-ever Series Fest is underway in Denver, Colorado. Elizabeth Wagmeister is a reporter at Variety. She's written a new story about TV embracing the festival format and is with us now. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
So why do festivals make sense for television?
Festivals make sense for television because the TV industry is just booming. There's more content than ever on more platforms than ever. And festivals are really a great place for new shows and returning shows to get exposure. The best fans for TV are the ones that are going to these festivals. So they eat up anything. And when they're there, they're going to tweet about it. They're going to go on Facebook. They're going to go on Instagram. And then the buzz spreads. And TV is really taking a nod from film festivals, which has been doing it for years.
So how much of this is attracting the attention of the super fans who will tweet this and Instagram it? And how much is about attracting the press who presumably will also cover these festivals?
It really goes hand in hand. You know, you hit it right on the head there. When press is at these film festivals, you know, they're going to cover it. They're writing stories. They're pushing out a lot of content. I know that I am. You know, I've been at South by Southwest. We had reporters at Austin Television Festival. We're getting ready to go to Comic-Con, and we're writing numerous stories per day, you know, at least 5, maybe up to 20. So that's going to spread. That also gets picked up on social media, and the word gets spread around.
Do you have any sense of whether or not the festival format is paying off for the shows? Lots of these festivals are really young, right?
A lot of these are really new, and they're really rising in popularity. And something else that's new is just the addition of TV to film festivals or tech festivals. It really doesn't cost a ton for the networks if they're just paneling. However, a lot of these networks and studios are hosting bigger events. You know, they may be the opening night kickoff party for a festival. And I've spoken to some heads of marketing at networks, and they say it's worth it because when you're launching a show, you're marketing anyway. You're spending a lot of money. So to spend money on a festival, you're getting the type of exposure which other shows may not be getting.
And how different are these television festivals than film festivals? Do you watch multiple pilots in a row, or is it one at a time?
There, some of them will have different screenings happening at the same time, so you have to choose. You know, a big example of that is Comic-Con, which, of course, is film and TV, but there's so many fans that want to go that every room is jam-packed. But other ones, they'll just have one screening at a time, and I think it depends on how mature these festivals are.
Are there any shows that you personally have discovered at these television festivals?
Yes, Mr. Robot, which is premiering this month on USA Network, that actually premiered at South by Southwest back in Austin in March. And I was there, and it screened, and it won the Audience Award, and that really put it on the mark. Because of that, it's been able to go to other festivals. So I spoke to the head of marketing for their network and said, you're really, you know, putting this talent out there. You're shipping them around the world. They don't get summer vacation. You're probably spending a lot of money on putting this one show out there? Is it really worth it? And they said, you know, to get those accolades before a show even premieres is priceless.
Elizabeth Wagmeister is a reporter at Variety. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Happy Father's Day to all you dads out there. Enjoy your weekend. Know we appreciate you. It struck us as a good a time as any to look at the hundreds of millions of dollars that have been poured into fatherhood programs over the last few years. The feds are betting on services that combine job training with less tangible skills. Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan reports.
If you work in social services in a town like Cheyenne, Wyoming, guys like Michael Pena are a big chunk of your budget.
I've been in and out of prisons, jails, drug possessions, and gun charges. It's been a rough one, man.
Pena's 35. He's not a big guy, but he's all muscle and covered in tattoos that run all the way to the top of his bald head. Up until a few years ago, he sold drugs with a local gang. Taxpayers shelled out a lot of money, paying for his prison stays and frequent trips to the ER.
Never had insurance. I got a lot of hospital bills now.
Pena worked some shifts at McDonald's and on construction sites, but nothing really stuck. He was too ticked off all the time, something he says he got from his dad.
He would go to the bar all night, so I never really seen him unless he was off that night and angry. Everything I learned from the streets.
But then Pena's sister got locked up, and Pena got custody of his 5-year-old nephew, Elijah. He was working construction at the time, and one of his buddies told him about Dad's Making a Difference, a federally funded training program for low-income fathers. He signed up for the free welding lessons, but on day one, instead of job training, he got Freud.
So the reason I asked about Freud is because you're going to get some education today on psychology and how your mind works.
Okay, so it may sound like a college psych class, but lessons like this one and how to handle your emotions are more than 50% of what goes on here. And since 2010, the Obama administration has spent over $333 billion funding hundreds of similar fatherhood programs around the country. The program director in Cheyenne, Chris Wiederspahn, says most guys sign up for the job training.
So we really focus on those vocational trades where not only jobs are available, but good-paying jobs are available.
But the softer stuff often turns out to be just as important to long-term stability. Wiederspahn says the skills you need to deal with a crying kid aren't so different from what you need to deal with a frustrating boss. Almost all of the guys who enroll in this program are felons or recovering addicts. But here in Cheyenne, 9 in 10 found jobs after graduating in the last few years, and most saw their wages go up by more than 50%.
You can't separate being a better dad versus being a better employee and a better citizen and not going back to prison. They're connected. It's all connected.
This is a pretty big shift from when fatherhood programs took off back in the 90s. David Miller is with fatherhood.gov.
A lot of the programs really looked at getting these guys jobs to pay child support.
But Miller says even if those dads could land jobs, they often struggled to keep them or didn't end up spending any of their paycheck on their kid. That's why Miller hopes that combining job training with life skills is a smart bet in the long term for the dad and for the taxpayer.
Addressing the anger, addressing the poor parenting is really important. And those are the kinds of things that if we can address, we increase the likelihood that this man will be able to be gainfully employed and keep the job.
Michael Pena graduated from the program last month, and he just landed a welding gig. Good money to help raise his nephew, Elijah.
I won't be upset with myself because I can provide for him.
Pena pulls out his smartphone to show me a video of the kid.
Man, he's fantastic. He's the best kid ever.
Pena says he owes their close relationship and his new job to the program, the welding classes, and the Freud. In Cheyenne, I'm Miles Bryan for Marketplace.
Coming up?
It's like everything else. Until there's a catastrophic event, then it's good enough.
Another look at the vulnerable electrical grid and some very, very local solutions. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 101 points, 0.5%, to end at 18,014. The Nasdaq slid 15 points, 0.3%, finishing at 5117. And the S&P 500 gave up 11 points, 0.5%, to close at 2109. For the week, the Dow gained 0.6%, the Nasdaq rose 1.3%, and the S&P added 0.7%. That's way better than the week China had. The Shanghai Composite down 13.3%. Cars get better mileage because the EPA insists on it. Now the agency has proposed higher standards for trucks. Those giant Peterbilt and Kenworth rigs you see on the interstate, they're made by PACCAR, which was off 0.1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
Marketplace is listener supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please consider making a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice, thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by June 30th.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for May. The National Old Time Fiddlers Contest and Festival gets underway in Weezer, Idaho. And it has that unforgettable spaghetti scene. Lady and the Tramp was released in theaters June 22, 1955. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. Taylor Swift does not play nice with streaming companies. She pulled all her music off Spotify last fall. We have news now that her album 1989 won't be available on Apple's new streaming service. Neither will the music of some independent artists and record labels who are running into their own problems with Apple. Turns out the company doesn't want to pay them during the first 3 months of its streaming service rollout. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
Apple is a company that's very close to the hearts and pocketbooks of many musicians. They use Apple technology to produce their product, and many make a decent living selling music in its iTunes store. But is all of that enough to convince independent artists to give away their music for free on Apple's new streaming service?
Maybe.
Jim DeRogatis is co-host of the show Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio. He says independent labels are right to be wary of any business model that devalues their product. Still, saying no to a company with the clout and reach of Apple is no easy call.
You know, many artists say it's better to have people listening to my music, even if I'm not making much money, than not listening.
But others say the fact that Apple spent months and months hammering out special arrangements with corporate labels only to give independents a take-it-or-leave-it offer just isn't fair.
You're talking about a significant portion of the market that's just dealt with as an afterthought, and that happened again with Apple.
Jesse Van Doom is the CEO of Cash Music, a nonprofit tech startup that provides business tools for musicians.
They're coming to people saying, look, we're going to do this streaming product. We are the biggest corporation in the world. We hold more money than God, and we're going to ask you to take the financial hit while we onboard customers.
Van Doom worries that Apple's move into streaming and away from retail risks killing a really important source of income for musicians.
And I think it feels to a lot of artists really like Apple's trying to make music just another feature of a phone.
I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Economies of scale. We talk about the idea all the time, making lots of something to bring the cost down. It works with electricity. Think about mega power plants supplying most of what we use from far, far away somewhere. Thing is, the delivery system, the plumbing of electricity, the grid is becoming less reliable in this country. So some places are going the other way and creating energy very, very locally. Yesterday, Scott Tong of our sustainability desk had a story of the power outage crisis in Connecticut. Today, part two an attempted solution.
If you live in Connecticut and have been walloped by record storms and blackouts lately, you start talking like this.
There was people out longer than 5 days without power.
And we were one of the last towns to get power back.
We had cell towers go down. They are actually powered by electricity.
There are electric wheelchairs. All of a sudden, people couldn't get around because they couldn't power their wheelchairs.
Eventually, the public will become so frustrated with the storm response of the traditional grid that they will demand the changes.
It's like everything else. Until there's a catastrophic event, then it's good enough.
Let's unpack. In 2011 and 2012, three giant storms blacked out power for up to 12 days each. High winds and floods took down wires, poles, and pieces of the grid that sends electricity from central power plants far away. State lawmaker Lonnie Reed.
You realize how centralized we are, and more centralization means more vulnerability.
It's really two vulnerabilities, a less reliable grid and our addiction to it. One of Reed's constituents called up during one of the storms demanding the National Guard.
And I said, well, is your house still standing? Oh, yes. Do you have water? Yes. And he said, my children can't go to school, and there is no TV, and they depend on video games, and he was having a Wii meltdown.
After the storms, Connecticut passed a law that's the first of its kind in the country. It invests in what are called microgrids. Yale Law professor Dan Esty was Energy and Environment Commissioner at the time.
And it became clear that there was an opportunity, while not protecting against the grid going out, of having some number of microgrids that would stay up.
A microgrid is what it sounds like, a hyper-local source of energy. It could be a natural gas plant, a solar panel, fuel cell that makes electricity independent of the main grid. Think community garden in case the ship food can't make it in. It's a form of decentralized, or what some call distributed generation. Danbury Hospital in western Connecticut put in its own system about 4 years ago. An on-site gas plant kept the lights on during Superstorm Sandy. Morris Gross is facilities VP.
We decided to go island mode. And island mode basically meant that we split away from the power company during the worst of that storm.
Of course, much of the region went dark then, including New York University's medical center in Manhattan.
So they had to evacuate their patients. These patients had to be carried downstairs and, you know, elevators don't work. I mean, you can imagine. I mean, you have to worry about people on respirators.
Danbury Hospital's microgrid makes local power and local heat. It captures the generator's waste heat, which normally goes up the smokestack, and turns it into steam.
We take the steam, we heat buildings with it. We take the steam, we create hot water with it. We take the steam, we sterilize instruments with it. And then we take the steam and we convert it to air conditioning through a heat absorption chiller.
The hospital saved so much money on heating and AC, it paid for its $17 million microgrid in 4 years. It's the same kind of story in our east, at Wesleyan University's microgrid.
We save about $5,000 per day operating these machines on campus.
University plant director Alan Rubaha says the school, like a hospital, cannot afford to go dark. The science lab, for instance, has strict temperature controls.
Certainly at stake there is science. In other words, the business of the university and of the students. We've got minus 80 freezers and minus 20 freezers with things in them that are irreplaceable.
Keeping a college building or a hospital lit is one of several reasons to make power locally. It can save money in places where grid power is expensive. It can generate clean energy in the form of rooftop solar panels. It can hedge against terrorist attacks on the physical grid, which is why the military is building microgrids. Again, Yale Law's Dan Esty.
There are so many reasons to have a structure of distributed generation that is going to happen with or without a strategy from government, with or without the support of the old utilities.
Utilities that are noticing. One industry paper calls distributed energy a disruptive threat. But not everyone is so sure. In Connecticut, say, there are legal hurdles. Say you live there and you want to build your very own microgrid. Does the law define what it is? Nope. Can you build one that crosses over or under a city street? Not sure. Are you subject to a bazillion laws that apply to utilities? Could be.
Lawyers are needed at every stage.
Sarah Bronin is with the University of Connecticut School of Law.
If a project has to comply with public utility rules, even more lawyers are needed, which is great for lawyers, but not great for microgrid development.
And then there's the barrier of energy pricing. For most of us, one unit of electricity costs the same, whether it's green or fossil, whether we're energy hogs or not, whether it's imported or made locally. Yale Law's Dan Esty wants to overhaul this pricing so consumers pay more for energy that's worth more.
You start to pay for redundancy, you pay for resiliency, you pay for any number of these attributes that have been kind of on the sidelines of the 20th century electricity marketplace.
An old electricity marketplace built yesterday for yesterday. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We'd love to hear about the infrastructure problems in your neighborhood. And we've got our entire infrastructure series, The Weak Link. It's all on our website at marketplace.org. This final note today, which I deliver to you, I'll admit it, with a healthy pinch of skepticism, but it's kind of amazing. And it's about pickles, one of the world's great foods. Researchers at William & Mary and the University of Maryland say they've discovered a connection between eating fermented foods like pickles and kimchi and feeling less anxious. Just think about it. Loading up on sauerkraut could help you ace that job interview. Well, maybe. Researchers still need to run experiments to see if they can prove any actual causation. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace this Friday. Today, the Dow fell 101 points, 0.5%. The Nasdaq slid 15 points, 0.3%. And the S&P 500 gave up 11 points, 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. Tommy Andres is acting senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Adrienne Hill. Have a great weekend. Kai's going to be back Monday. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.